Beverly Taylor, chorus director for the Madison Symphony, thank you so much for joining us today.
A pleasure. My first interview since COVID.
Mine as well. So let's get that elephant out of the room. When did you know you were going to do a Missa Solemnis, and how much was it delayed?
John Demain picked it about 2.5 years before we actually performed it. And at the time, it looked like we'd be doing it the year after COVID finished. And so it was already in the schedule, in the brochures, and then we found out the COVID restrictions would be continuing so that our ability to rehearse in person or unmasked would be not a possibility. And then that made the rehearsal of it very, very difficult. We were able to do it, we're excited to do it, but it was hard.
Obviously, a string player can wear a mask and not need to worry about how it affects their sound. Wind players, you can find workarounds with a mask to still play a wind instrument. How does one sing through a mask?
Well, there are a couple different masks that make it a little bit easier. There are some that are built out more, which allow a little more air around the sound. They look like baby feed masks, you know, like
I've seen some that look like plague masks.
And we use them, although sometimes they're hot and people would come up with their own. The hardest thing for the listener is getting enough consonant. Some of the sound is lost, but maybe not that much. What was funny was at the beginning of COVID, people kept asking me things I couldn't answer. Well, can we do this? I don't know. How much sound will we lose? I don't know. How will the diction be? I don't know. And I finally said, if you want me to come up statistics, here we go. I think we'll lose a third of the sound and a third of the consonants. You have it on reliable authority. And they said, can you talk to your colleagues doing other major choruses around the country? And I said, nobody is doing this. We're all in the same boat. Well, how did they do it in Los Angeles? They canceled. How did they do it in the Berkshires? They canceled. Or doing it with masks. So we had to come up with our own hopes and dreams. The one difference, we needed a little miking to make up for some of the diction and sound lost, and we have a very good sound system. So normally with a classical piece, we need no miking at all. This was a little just around the edge, no big deal, but just to make sure the projection was there and that the consonants were as clean as we could make them. It did mean in training we had to over-exaggerate the consonants quite a bit. And sometimes then you can lose tone. So it was trying to find the right amount.
And there's always that I have to overcompensate, so I might actually have to push my voice past what somebody once said, louder than lovely. You know, there's a tendency to want to oversing just because you want to be heard so badly.
Exactly. And we have to fight that always. We say, you know, never sing louder than you can beautifully. Yes, give me more if you have it. It's something you work out in rehearsal. What is the loudest you can sing in a way that is still healthy and beautiful?
So there was even more work behind the scenes to bring this to the stage. Everybody knows the Ninth. Everybody adores the Ninth. The Ninth is an amazing piece of music, but the chorus is only in the fourth movement, and they sing for maybe half of it.
Yes, it's about 15 to 17 minutes of singing, whereas the Missa Solemnis is over an hour, and I consider it one of the two hardest pieces for choruses to sing because it's vocally demanding. Beethoven was an instrumentalist, and he wrote sometimes, I guess I would call it theoretically, idealistically. That is, he knew the overall sound and effect he wanted, but he was pretty much not a singer, and he was deaf at the point, but I think it was more that he was just not a singer, so he gets the overall effect, the chords. It's exciting to listen to, but it is really hard, really high. I think of this and the B minor Mass of Bach as the two hardest things to sing. Well, the B minor Mass was written not to be performed altogether. It was written in stages. But when we do it now, it is exceptionally vocally demanding on the group, normally done with a smaller chorus than the Madison Symphony. But this is about as hard as you get. There are some modern works that have greater demands vocally or with some strange harmonies, but this is just out and out a powerhouse, a marathon.
A powerhouse marathon indeed. Mm-hmm. So Beethoven wrote a Mass, a fairly standard setting of the Mass in 1807, I believe.
I think the Beethoven Mass in C, which is very classical. A lot of it could be thought of as like Mozart or Haydn. There are still some Beethovenian touches, a lot of sforzandos and a couple weird chord changes and changes of mood, but it's one that's very accessible, very beautiful, and done by a lot of standard choruses. Not many take on the Missa Solemnis. It's way more demanding. And the first demand of it is range. The basses are singing most of the time in baritone range, few low parts. The tenors are up almost to alto range, the altos to soprano range, and the sopranos talk only to God. I mean, it's just really up there. And every time you do it, you have to make sure you have enough high sopranos because most of the second sopranos are going, please, may I sing alto for this? And you need them for that because they're so high. So whereas we might boost sections in certain ways in a normal distribution, this, all of it, you're adding on to the higher voice.
So why did Beethoven write such a big and such a demanding Mass? Did he have a commission for it? Why was this work even thought of?
Beethoven's patron, the Archduke, had been made a bishop, and so it was time for a great celebratory piece. But by the time he was installed, this was huge. The work was really too big, and it could not be used for liturgical use because there were dramatic things that come back and forth and just the very size of it. So it's a great celebration, but it probably outgrew its original inspiration.
Beethoven was raised Catholic, correct?
Yes.
But this is not... By the time he wrote this, he wasn't really writing as a Catholic. We are in the Age of Enlightenment. How does that change what a Mass would be in 1824?
Well, liturgically, it would have been much more simple. By the time you get to this, there is this sense of dramatic linking together of parts, and certain themes keep coming back again and again. You hear running things of the Gloria, and what I would call aspiration motives, things that leap up and run up, and they come in the Ninth Symphony too, things that get you out of the chair and rising up. So I think of it sometimes as an extended hand toward the sky, you know, reaching, reaching, reaching. And he aspires with the notes and with the grandeur of sound, except actually in the last minute, which is sort of like a peaceful afterthought. And most people go, what happened? Why did it end so quietly? And we don't have a good answer for that.
Why do you think it ended quietly?
I see it sort of as an afterglow, the sunset. We've achieved it, and then it's sort of making a merry farewell to a text that often is grimmer, the Agnus Dei, your Lamb of God, take away our sins. In fact, it always struck me a little closer to the Sixth Symphony in that after the storm, and then you have this very pacific music that is graceful and beautiful. And to me, it's a little bit that after sort of the storm and the passionate and the high notes, it's a gentle ending.
And it's also in the Agnus Dei, a lot of trumpets and drums. We've got a military cast to it, and obviously Beethoven didn't want to leave us there.
No. You hear the drums and you hear that, and then for the Dona Nobis Pacem, it's as if it never was. And there's this emphasis on peace. Grant us peace or grant them peace. Yes, so very, very different from those echoes you hear with the end of the pleading on you stay. It's briefly very, very passionate, and then just disappears.
We've jumped ahead of ourselves. We've gone to the end. Let's start at the beginning. The Kyrie, fairly standard at this point, not too different from what we might expect, or does he surprise us even this early?
He surprises us early, but not in a way that's, it may not be caught by everybody, but our very first word, the Kyrie, which is Lord of Mercy, it's forte Kyrie and a subito piano. Some people may interpret that as a diminuendo to a piano, but almost everybody does it loud and a sudden soft. And I like to acknowledge it as pleading to God and suddenly humble, as if you're going, can you help me? And then you're looking down at your knees. It's sort of Kyrie. And we do the plea three times. But that is not standard. If it were Haydn, you would have it forte throughout. It's a great announcement. But this sudden piano is a surprise. And you need to change the chorus so that there are no inadvertent solos there on the last syllable.
And then the Gloria. Beethoven knows how to write glory.
He does know how to write glory. It's very fast and gets faster. In fact, I think most of the singers might choose this as their favorite movement to sing because although it's fast, loud, and high, it's not as high and weird as the Credo. It's just great fun. It's a real motor piece. The only thing really tough at the opening is the orchestra is quite loud, and it starts with just the altos, or it's written as altos, gloria, gloria. Well, no alto section can be heard. It's mid to low range. And the whole orchestra is in. So what we do is every single person on stage sings the first measure. I said, let the altos color the sound. But actually, just about everybody except the lowest basses sings the first measure to be heard. And then the tenors break off and go high. So a good chorus master has to play around with the balances there for the modern size orchestra.
Not everybody who is listening to this is a singer. What exactly do you mean by color in a voice?
My theory is not every voice should sound identical to everything else. You want a blend within parts and sort of a similar vibrato rate or nod or way of attack. But basically, sopranos tend to have a purer, cleaner sound, or it could be heavy and operatic, but the altos have a warmth and lusciousness if it's a female alto. If it's done by male alto, it sounds more like early music. It's a powerful but straighter sound. I'm stereotyping here, but that's it. The tenors, the regular tenor range, when they're singing an A above middle C, say, it will sound beautifully piercing and strong and very vibrant and reedy. That same A by an alto, it's in their middle range, so it will sound warm and luscious, but not have the ability to project and pierce well. So it really depends where it is in their range. So if the alto starts singing from D to A, you know it will be mellow, but cannot reach everybody. However, I like the altos to sound alto-y. So you add enough people. Basically, I put on sopranos. I said, if you have or can do an alto cast or a mezzo cast, do it. Because otherwise it sounds like little girls singing or like tenors trying to blend in and not quite. So that's why in COVID, when we were rehearsing sometimes separately on Zoom, this drove me crazy because you cannot do adjustments like this until everybody's in the same room.
To the Credo, which is full of words, text, text, text heavy. And the temptation for a lot of composers would be set it in unison as much as possible, don't get fancy, get through the text, and save your singers for the end. Beethoven doesn't do that, does he?
Oh, it's by far, it's by far the hardest movement. And the first time I sang it, actually with Robert Shaw in a workshop in New Jersey, and I didn't know the work as well, because very often you don't study that much because it's just not done that much. So you're doing the more doable works way before you study the Missa Solemnis. And I got to the fugues and it's like, you've got to be kidding. You know, fast, loud, great fun. But he sets the fugue, particularly in old and new style. He writes in half notes. The Et Vitam Venturi, which is the formula for the end and everlasting life. He sets it in half notes, and it's still very hard harmonically and melodically. The altos have probably the weirdest of the settings. Tenors do a lot. Basses, it's not easy, but they have the easiest of the four parts in the Credo. Sopranos are hard and in barking dog territory. It takes months for them, and the sound is beautiful by the end, but sight reading it, you're either reading it down an octave or you're barking. It's hard because, again, he wanted to show up, I believe, but it's insane. So the old style fugue, it's imitative, a little slow. And then he double times it. He writes it in quarter and fast notes. Mercifully, that section is short. And again, it gets fun to sing. But you've got to remember the Madison Symphony did three performances of this 3 days in a row, plus three other rehearsals during the week. And I had to talk to John Demain, and the chorus gets so excited they get the bitten in their teeth. But I said, you have to please let them mark. And marking is our short term for singing his half voice. You sing at the right time and stuff, but you simply don't turn on the full volume. So mark some of the movements on the Tuesday rehearsal, some of the movements on Wednesday or Thursday, just to give them a rest. You have to set the balances so that it's right for the auditorium. But if you expect them to get to three full performances, then you have to allow a little bit of rest. Now, conductors know that from working with soloists. If you're doing a Verdi Requiem, believe me, they don't sing three rehearsals full voice and have it left for the weekend. They have to preserve themselves. So you do some high, loud parts to set it, and then they may take everything else down an octave that they've already rehearsed. And this is just because we're humans, and that's what makes it so delightful to hear. But you have to protect the voice if you're doing multiple performances.
Getting into the Sanctus and the Benedictus, these are movements that I associate with the voice, blessings and something quiet and gentle and nurturing about those words. And here Beethoven is giving some beautiful lines, what you would think of as cantabile, singing lines to the orchestra.
Yes, the orchestra has some lovely melodic lines, and the soloists take most of the calmness. Now, with some other composers, sometimes Sanctus, which is one of the oldest things, holy, 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 and Kadosh Kadosh from the Hebrew, it's one of the oldest songs of praise. And Haydn's Sanctuses tended to be big and regal and big chords, some of these big things called attention. The Benedictus usually is more curvy and nurturing and melodic. In this case, though, the Sanctus, the orchestra has a little bit more melody to play, and the soloist singing quite low and conservatively also do the melody. The chorus is reserved to break through with Pleni Sunt Celi, the heavens and earth are full of your glory. And then they let loose with a very short and high little spurt, sort of coming, it's just about a 30-second run. Then the Benedictus again features the soloist a good bit, but the chorus comes in as well. Again, one of the worries for the chorus master is the basses of the chorus sing three measures right near the beginning to start it off, and then they disappear till the chorus comes in. That's always struck me as an odd thing. I can't say why he didn't. There's no reason not to do it, but it's sort of like, oh, yes, have we rehearsed this? It's, you know, because it's repeated note. It's giving a little bit of a chant background, sort of a monotone before these wonderful melodic lines that are in the orchestra, followed by the soloists. And the chorus in this, even though they're loud sometimes, is more of a backup group. It's the sort of Gladys Knight and the Pips, and we're the Pips. In nomine Domine, we chant behind the soloists. And after such hard singing in the credo, the chorus is happy not to be doing quite so much as they've done up to that time.
You've made it very, very clear. This is not an easy work. And this is not a work that most singers will have a chance to do or do more than once in a choral career. What did the singers tell you they discovered in working through this piece?
The sopranos are always talking about how high it is, but they loved it. They love to soar if they're high sopranos. The altos talked about, quite rightly, how unbelievably hard it was. There are portions of the credo and a little bit in the Gloria that really can sound like a sight reading test, because the voice leading is not always predictable. Voice leading is the term we use for how one melodic part, how one voice moves, whether it's stepwise motion or leap, but there's usually an internal logic to it. Beethoven observes that some of the time, but has them, for harmonic reasons, sometimes leap right out of that area. So the voice leading is more predictable in Bach. It may go faster, but it is a little less so with Beethoven, as if he wrote the orchestra and some of the grand melodies first, wanted to work out the harmony, but he sometimes stitched together some quite weird intervallic turns for the altos, and the same for the tenors, who are also working high. So they were proud because they worked their heads off to learn it, and I think pride came forth. Tenors had the pride of both a high part and hard one, and basses had some very hard licks to do. So during COVID, Zoom is one way. I taught it. We had people play, but I can't hear them back. To hear people back, you can work it out with studio recordings. Sometimes you can do it with a big group if everybody has the same equipment and headphones, but basically you're not hearing it in an ambient space. So it's a little bit trust. I hope you get this. And until I heard them together, I would not know for sure. So to help the matter, we had 4 to 6 singers, just one on a part. They alternated the weeks that we were truly on Zoom because of either COVID or snow. Then we met together, thanks to Mike Ross and the Madison Youth Choirs. We met in their facilities and had speakers on screen over the Zoom mechanism so they could hear their part sung by their part. Because before then, the early teaching, I would maybe play the bass part. I could sing it up an octave. But we thought for faster learning and timbre, we would get good examples. So I'm grateful to the sopranos, altos, tenors, and basses who helped that process to keep us on our toes until we could get together. And in person, what you might not realize was I was hampered too. I had to wear a mask. So they hooked up a lavalier mic to me. So with a mic and a mask and headphones for the mic, I was like a space creature. Normally, I don't need amplification when I run a rehearsal. But also in rehearsals, I sometimes walk it up and down the aisles, just looking for matched vowels and stuff. It was impossible to do. I was wired. I could, every time I used a big gesture, I would knock my amplification off. We have terrible sounds of falling equipment. So it was fun, but difficult. That's why there were times I really wondered if we could do it. But everyone knew what was at stake. So they did everything possible. We had study groups. We had people, and this is not my first choice, but they listened to some existing tapes and helps just so they could practice. Just had to warn them again and again, when you use stuff like that, it can be very stifling. This is not necessarily the tempo we're using. This is not necessarily the tone. But if you're not in rehearsal and need reinforcement, this is a way to practice it. So we did some of that and then had to do a little extra work when we were together to make up for the fact of building an ensemble, which is the hardest thing about chorus, and most people don't understand. When I say ensemble, it's not simply in the intonation. The hardest thing of all for a big chorus is to sing together with themselves and then with the orchestra. The most basic rule, which this may sound so elementary as to why you'd say it, but it's the difference between a lot of choruses, is when you sing with an orchestra, the most sound you produce is by the vowel. And to sing on time, the vowel needs to be lined up with the orchestra beat, not the first consonant. So if you sing glory, they're always saying, chorus, you're late. The chorus doesn't feel they're late. They sang gl on time. But they gl has too little sound. It sounds like you're in time with the O, with the beat. So you have to learn, as I put my hand down, glow, that the O is with my finger and not the glow, or with the maestro's baton. And this means a shift. And when you're working at home, there's no need to do that. No one's pounding a meter. That's, again, the problem with Zoom. So you have to build the ensemble quickly with all these initial things so that they sound together with the orchestra and not behind. So that's the technical reason, but it's harder than it looks. If you're used to singing on time, one way to move that just tiny bit hair forward. It's not singing early. It's a placement of the vowel with the beat. And that's one of the chief jobs I have to do when we get together, is oriented so they can be with John Demain and not just singing with themselves.